While the Western film genre has been on a decline the last few decades, its themes and iconography continue to have a lasting impact on how we think as a society and how we view our history. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. Today, I continue my conversation about Western films and their impact on our culture with my guest, Celine Dipp. Dipp is a senior at El Paso High School with an interest in media studies and has been creating an online collection of dialogues about a range of subjects related to American media and culture. We pick up the conversation where we left off last week.
Yeah, in departing, I guess, from those decades, 60s and 70s, you've had, I guess, little splotches of sure. Westerns, I guess, pairs that have come. And then now there are, I guess, a couple that have shown up recently. But do you think, now looking at it, do you think that the Western is dead? And I guess to finish up, do you think that there is a future for that genre?
I don't think the Western will ever die. In some regards, it's gone into hiding in other forms. You know, I think of modern Westerns like No Country for Old Men, mm-hmm. or a great one like Hell or High Water.
Yeah.
You know, these are modern West films that incorporate some of the notion, a lingeringness of the old Western and the old West, and they're set in the West. The film Logan, which was a Marvel film, about Wolverine, the last film of the X-Men franchise, at least until recently, is infused with Western motifs and feels like a Western, even though it's set in the future. And it's about this comic book character. Mm-hmm. So there are directors that are still influenced by the Western and weaving some of that in. I think on TV, you know, I don't know if you ever watched the Joss Whedon early TV show, Firefly. It's a sci-fi Western. I mean, through and through. They even wear holsters. Now they don't have six shooters. So the Western will move on. You know, the Coen brothers recently remade True Grit as a fabulous film. There's a wonderful film called Meek's Cutoff by the director Kelly Reichardt. I highly recommend. So they're still being made. Bone Tomahawk just a few years ago. There were three Westerns that year, and that was the lowest budget one. And it came out the year of Quentin Tarantino's Hateful Eight came out, as well as the year that The Revenant came out, which is a very different type of Western. So they're still going to be made. The stories are still powerful. The imagery of the lone person or, you know, human against nature in this vast landscape is still compelling. But also a lot of those stories and iconography ports itself over into other genres that when you've seen enough Westerns, you can identify it. And so it's there. It's right under the surface. It just bubbles up from time to time.
I'd also be really interested to hear your take on, I guess, since audiences are watching this and they kind of have this detached sense from the Western and this detached sense of understanding from these realities that these people are living, how in its, I guess, peak through the golden age of Hollywood and 40s, 50s, how were audiences able to relate to Westerns?
Well, that may have been part of the decline of the Western in the 80s and 90s. Is, you know, if you think about society in America and step out of movie world, you know, in the silent period and into the 30s and 40s, you know, a lot of American population was still centered in rural communities. And they have a direct link. I mean, they were seeing horses and farms and people dealing with the elements, you know, like they did in their own lives. There was a familiarity with those environments that people in the 20s and 30s and 40s had. And then, of course, in the post-war era, you know, you have the rise of the suburbs. The migration to the cities is now turning into a migration out to the suburbs. And there's different issues at stake then. You know, you get to the 50s and there's a Cold War and there's this, the Black Hats are the Russians and the Soviet Union, the godless people, and America is a place of God-fearing people, and capitalism versus communism, and, you know, capitalism and capital in Westerns has a place as well that most people don't think about, but it's often about property rights. It's about who owns what. It's about who got there first and could grab as much land as they could. It's about the banker that owns the mercantile and owns the bar and owns everything and therefore has his thumb on everyone because everyone is indebted to that person. So there's all of those issues. But getting back to your question, what I think you're getting at is this popularity and then the waning of it. I'm not so sure, you know, that just the removal of most of our culture from work on farms and rural life didn't play a role in that by the 60s and 70s. That not just do you have the aging out of these Western directors and actors and famous stars, but the urbanization of so many stories and with television. You know, Westerns were incredibly popular in the 50s and 60s on television too. You have Gunsmoke and Rifleman and Rawhide and, you know, Bonanza, and it goes on and on and on. But those start to wane off too. And both in television and movies by the 70s, you see a lot of the storylines that were getting worked out in Westerns all of a sudden becoming police procedurals. So those issues of law and order, to me, there's an obvious link between a film like Dirty Harry and Clint Eastwood's character in that film and the Westerns he was playing and the Western deeply of this man who is trying to enforce his own code. And in this case, it's a contemporary film set in San Francisco, and he's a police officer, and he breaks the law himself because the legal justice system that he works within, he has determined on his own, is not serving society the way it should. And so he's taking matters into his own hand. And that's a storyline that could be in a Western 20 years earlier. But now it's set in a cop procedural, an action film. Of course, Eastwood comes out of the Western genre right into that. Charles Bronson with his Death Wish films, he did plenty of Westerns too. And so I think in the 70s, you actually see this morphing of a lot of those themes into the police procedurals. And maybe in hindsight, not in a good way, because many of those characters are basically, without saying so, are undermining our own sense of the justice system, that it's unfair, and therefore they're having to act alone and often in a vigilante type scenario. And some of that is still going through our popular culture now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even with the decline of the Western through populations and that shift and kind of that detachment and need to, I guess, supplement the Western in a framework that is more palatable to audiences in the 80s and 90s, I'm really interested in how they kind of, or individuals.
Well, let me stop you there. Meaning that you think one of the reasons is that the conflict between cowboys and Indians, Native Americans, Mexicans, whatever, is no longer palatable by the 80s and 90s, and you just can't sustain that sort of, at least that line of the Western. I think that's an interesting notion.
Yeah, I was kind of talking more to the shift from rural to urban, but I do think definitely there was, and I was surprised to, you know, in my research, find out that there were revisionist Westerns as early as the 50s,
sure,
which is so interesting because you had films in the 30s and 40s, the Western epics that really leaned into those ideas of what a Western had to be and those, I guess, tropes and specifically racial tropes that marred that genre. And then you go into the 50s and a decade after, years after these films that really committed to those ideas, you have revisionist Westerns that are saying, well, we should focus a different attention and we should look at a different position to analyze these stories.
That's a good point. You know, there is a subset of the Western that, as you say, are revisionist Westerns. And it's probably a good place to point out that we should not watch any movie, Western or otherwise, for our history. Because first and foremost, the studios produce these as entertainments and to make money. But you're right that a lot of Westerns over the years depicted not just a fictionalized West, but often actual events. And so you think of all of the versions of like the gunfight at the OK Corral, which actually happened. And all of the characters in those movies, whether it's John Ford's My Darling Clementine or a newer film like from the 80s, Tombstone, you know, there are actors playing Wyatt Earp, who actually existed at one time in history. Doc Holliday, the Clanton brothers, you know. So we know from reading history that those events actually happened, and now these are fictionalized versions of how that happened and extrapolating things out of them to make for good movies. It doesn't necessarily make for good history. But I think one of the things you might want to look into in college and media studies is how movies have in many ways taken that role of this suggesting to us a diffuse knowledge of history, that somehow it is subconsciously imparting to us notions of our own history, which are not accurate, but we ingest it with all our other media and all of our other stimulations that we get from the internet and other places. And we're probably not even aware of how it's distorting our own notion of our own past as a and society. So that would be something really interesting, I think, to get into. But that revisionist Western, you know, particularly when you get to the 60s and 70s, yeah, you see certain directors, and often this is the rise of new directors. It's a new age. The studio system is crumbling. It's a culture in the 60s that is actively looking at itself, like with the Vietnam War, with the peace movement, sexual liberation. I mean, it's so many topics, racism. You have the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s. It's a culture in that time that is taking a hard look at what is going on and no longer accepting the authority of those who are telling them this is the way things are and should be. They're really questioning all of those things. And so it's maybe no surprise that in that period you also get films and Westerns who are also questioning the old tropes and the old formulas.
Mm-hmm. And what I think is so interesting is just Westerns aren't, I mean, like you were saying, they aren't as indicative to the actual history so much as they spoke to the perspectives of the people that did have the means to tell those stories in that time, which I think, I mean, is just a subject that permeates all throughout media and filmmaking specifically. But I'm also interested, aside from just considering the Western and its waning through its politics and also the genre conventions that I guess became a little bit lost on audiences with time, people have said on numerous occasions that the Western is par excellence. So I'd be interested, I guess, as to how you interpret that phrase or whether or not you think...
That sounds like a French film writer might have said that.
Yeah, I should probably attribute, it was Robert Warshaw and Andre Bazin. I think they wrote a paper and they described the par excellence Western
film. Andre is one of the great 50s and 60s French film writers. You know, the French were really attuned to American cinema in the 50s, and there were they were the early cultural writers about that. You know, we didn't catch up until the late 60s and 70s looking at film as an art form, but the French were doing it in the 50s, and Andre Bazin was one of them. And he saw the Western as the truly distinct American cinema form. And I think the reason why is that it is so American is because it was America. You don't have Polish Westerns. These were our stories. And so while there were dramas and horror films and science fiction films and comedies and romantic comedies and period romances and all of these other types of films being made at the same time Westerns were made, they were being made around the world. The Western was native to America. Now, that began to flower a bit in the 60s and 70s with overseas Westerns, but for most of the period of Western film, from the silent period to through the 50s, when Bazin would have written that statement, he would have looked at the Western as this uniquely American native art form within film. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where that notion comes from and why he thinks of it as being so distinctly American. Now, maybe the world sees Westerns derogatorily as distinctly American. You know, this notion, this myth of the individual has permeated, I think, the last century of American thought. The swagger of John Wayne, you know, the world sees as us being in endless wars all around, telling other people what to do, enforcing our norms or what we want on others. So in many regards, I think cultural critics look at Westerns and see that big rancher or the banker that owns everything and everyone has to do what they say because they are indebted to them. They can extrapolate that out as America on the political stage, in the world stage, as analogous as well. And so maybe in that regard, I don't know that Bazin was getting at that time, but that's another way that others might see the Western as distinctly American, because it says something about who we are also, mm-hmm. but perhaps not as positively.
Yeah. And what is really interesting is just, you know, how the Western was bred from these notions of American progress, whatever that meant, during that time period, and also Manifest Destiny. Mm. So when these directors wow. and these stories were being told during that time, do you think that that was more this sense of trying to hang on to those ideas, or do you think it was kind of a look back at that time as something that had was done and gone?
Well, that notion of Manifest Destiny, I think that arrived in the early 19th century when we were beginning our Western expansion, and it was a notion that somehow God had given us all of this land mm-hmm. to do with, you know, in a very Adam type sense, you know, you are going to go out and make this into what you want. Again, it overlooks the fact that there were a lot of people already living on the land who the Native Americans who had been there for thousands of years, but it was part of the cultural messaging to people, go, you know, spread and head out west and make a life for yourself, but also colonize it for us, a country. So the concept of Manifest Destiny that arose in the 1800s certainly propelled people and supported the notions of why we could go and kill all the buffalo and why we could go and enact genocide on Native Americans, because we were doing it in some ways because God gave it to us to do what we want, but also because God wanted us to do that. And that's where it gets real dangerous. Of course, by the time they're making Western films, they are looking back at a period, but there would have still been people who were pioneers in that age, still alive in the 20s and 30s when these films were being made. They would have been older, but those notions don't just die with a generation. They get passed on. They become part of the cultural milieu that we all grow up in. We absorb these notions subconsciously. And those directors I mentioned earlier, you know, who were born in the late 19th century, that would have been part of the notion too. It's this sort of American exceptionalism that, and truly, you know, America wouldn't be here if it weren't for the fact that, you know, all this land was available. And we were able to expand across it. There's a lot of downsides to that, which, you know, I think we're familiar with now. But within the Western, yeah, I don't know that there's a direct link between the people who made them and this notion, trying to support this notion in the 20th century of Manifest Destiny. But there's certainly a romantic sense that the sacrifices and travails that people went through to pioneer the hard life of moving out west into uncertainty, into unknown territory, and living or dying, you know, with no support around you. There was certainly an interest in that as a dramatic story, and it made for great stories. And so that's why people in Westerns are edified, you know. Now, you get to a film like How the West Was Won, which is a real distortion of, and a big Cinerama A picture, you know, with huge stars and one of these omnibus films that's made up of multiple segments that begins with Jimmy Stewart in the early 1800s, you know, going down a big river, and then it moves on to the Civil War and it moves on to Western expansion. And but it sets itself up as a film as telling this noble story. So in that regard, you know, it's harnessing the power of the cinema to elevate all of that, this remarkable Western expansion. So there were films that I think trafficked in those messages, but I don't know that they would have consciously been aware they were doing that. It's just that, you know, they had a very romantic notion, which was also supported by media in the 19th century, whether it was the dime novels or the pictures of Frederick Remington that were already mythologizing what the West was for most people who would never see the West. I mean, most people who saw these Westerns, or most people in the 19th century back east that were reading these novels of the West, they were the movies for that time. You know, they were totally fictionalizing this incredible place mm-hmm. that they would never see themselves.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's an answer, but it's...
No, it definitely is. And I think I just, like, considering that, I mean, if you look at the history of the Western, early 20th century, the first two decades, you had, like, the B-Western and kind of that development of an idea of what a Western should be. Mm-hmm. And then that led into the, you know, broadening of stories that were Westerns in the 30s and 40s, and then going into the 50s and 60s, and I guess the later decades of that century, you had the spaghetti Westerns, which tried to, mm-hmm. I guess, approach the Western again and make it relevant or consider it in a new way, or in a way that I guess would revive the Western. So you have these fluctuations and these resurgencies of the Western. Mm-hmm. So do you think, I mean, looking back at the different periods that have gone through the Western, how do you examine those insurgency or like those resurgences? And do you think they were successful? Do you think there was any point to trying to bring back that genre in that time period?
Bring back the Western in the 60s or 70s mm-hmm. that people were actively trying to do that? I don't know that they were actively, you know, the Western was still fairly popular in the 60s and even into the 70s. But I think there was an emergence in the 60s of new voices and directors and talent that were not born at the turn of the last century, that were part of the modern world, that were post-World War II. So if in the case of Sergio Leone, you know, he looked at the possibilities of the Western and these vast landscapes contrasted with the lone figure and the power of just the imagery of that, as well as the violence. And he combined that with his own native sense of opera, mm-hmm. you know, to create this hybrid film that nobody had really seen anything quite like it. Even the film score in those films of Sergio Leone are extraordinary and different, you know, and often include instruments that we never would have heard in American Westerns. So he's still filtering the Western and taking from the American Western things that impress him visually and story-wise, but still making it very Italian. You know, the Italians were one of the few that could produce an entire few decades of output of spaghetti Westerns, even though they were often made in Spain. It's interesting. Of course, Clint Eastwood, you know, if it weren't for the Italian spaghetti Western, the three he made with Sergio Leone, mm-hmm. he would not have become an international superstar. And he himself would go on and was indebted to the Western in that regard. And he would go on to make more Westerns, even leading up into the 90s, into his Academy Award winning Unforgiven, which, if you want to talk revisionism, it's not so much revising history, but it's looking back at the Western. It's a summing up of the Western and why that film is so important and the effect of violence on a culture and on an individual. Mm-hmm. You know, his character, Will Money, in that film has this very dark past, which we're told he's settled down and a woman of faith has brought him around. And now late in life, he needs to go do this one thing to help his kids to get money. And it leads to a series of violent interactions that lead to him reclaiming his sinful past and just, you know, wreaking carnage on those around him because he's very adept at with a gun. But step by step with each killing in that film, the people who do the killing are deeply affected by that killing, and it really delves into that. And so, you know, I think some Westerns beginning in the 50s and certainly into the 60s and certainly with the Westerns of Eastwood, he's very knowledgeable by the 80s and 90s of what he's making and the impacts of violence on the people in the film and by extension us. So he's commenting in that way on those elements of the Western that often just rolled right off our backs.
Okay, yeah, thank you. I think that clarifies that.
Well, this has been a treat. I love talking about Westerns, and I never get to. So I am so excited for where your research takes you. I hope you will keep me in the loop as you go off to college, but it's a fascinating subject, and I wish you all the best, Celine.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
I've been discussing some aspects of the American Western film and how it has shaped our culture and understanding of history with El Paso High School senior Celine Dipp. She'll be attending college next year and specializing in media studies. Dipp has been recording interviews about American culture with a number of participants, along with her sister Allie Dipp, and you can find those at ourworkproject.org, and that's our O-U-R. For an extended version of our conversation, log on to the On Film archive at ktep.org. On Film was engineered and recorded by Seth Van Meter. I'm Charles Horak. Stay safe, wear a mask, and thank you for listening to On Film.